This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
So I work at MoMA, and often I love to show this slide first when I do a presentation because it's MoMA, the facade, about, what, 50 years ago, when Alfred Barr was our director. And Barr was quite a prescient individual, an art historian, came from Harvard, and five people founded MoMA, who became the leading trustees for the first, you know, two decades. But he created departments of architecture and design, painting and sculpture, prints. We got a huge gift from one of the Rockefellers of our print collection. That's what got that started. In 35, a couple of years after we were founded, we added film and we added photography, and video was added to the program in the mid-70s. So the little sign on the facade says Art in Our Time. And those many of you art historians like Jerry in the back know that Alfred Barr had a lot of very profound ideas, but one was that the museum and art history was like a torpedo moving in time, and that as it moved, we would add the new and we would get rid of the old. And of course, we did give to the Met a couple of Cezannes and a couple of other things, and when we realized those were escalating, and if we're going to get rid of the old, then we have to get rid of our staff too, who have those specialties. So that went out the window. So thank goodness. So the institution continues to grow. You know, we had a renovation expansion. We reopened around 04, and we keep kind of reinvigorating ourselves, adding new staff. A wonderful colleague was added in painting and sculpture. Of course, Ann Temkin now is the chief curator in painting and sculpture, but Dorian Chun just came with a specialty in Japan and Asia, which is an area of great interest to me. But there's a lot more cross-departmental collaboration and discourse, which is quite exciting. I'm now part of not only our contemporary working group, but a group called CMAP. We were given a huge collection of Fluxus material from the Silvermans from Detroit. So it means that there's now a small room in our fourth floor with a lot of Fluxus material, something we were sorely lacking. So Fluxus was, of course, a kind of, you could say, a movement in the 60s where taking from the everyday, they were very much on the, in quote, cutting edge, very contrarian. I'm going to start with the first video because a contrarian who I knew, who sadly passed away a couple of years ago, was Nam June Paik. And I'm sure many of you here knew Nam June, but I met Nam June early, probably in 73, at a conference up at the Iverson Museum when David Ross was then the young curator up at the Iverson. And I was on a bus. We were all moving around Syracuse. There was a great experimental media program at the university, and Nam June just laughed and laughed as I was telling him that I had just come from Islamic art studies, had actually studied here at Penn to do Persian. And he said to me, because I was starting media, and he said, oh, it's all about ideas. You know, it can go across the trade route on the ideas on the back of camels, or it can go across the airwaves. And that was Nam June and some of the very early people I met who were so open in their thinking. So, of course, Nam June came out of music, was in Germany after being a student in Japan doing philosophy, then was very close to a lot of music people in the early 60s. He met Cage early on. Then he came to New York, and the Fluxus connections opened certain doors in New York. There are a couple of people who still are alive who helped him a lot. And he lived early on Canal Street. And those of you who know New York know that it was hardware heaven, Canal Street. Now it's Gucci replica heaven for tourists, but then you would have bins and bins of old electronic material just, you know, collected on the street from these recycling people. So Nam June would grab up all of those materials, take them into his loft, tinker with the TV, doctor up the insides. He'd have on rubber boots because he was maybe going to get electrocuted, so he didn't want to die. So that was Nam June, this man with an amazing smile and twinkle in his eyes. So he had studied, he was really a classical pianist and was very, very well trained. But of course, he kind of didn't put it all out the window, but twisted it a lot. It's not apocryphal. He did get one of the early portable cameras in New York. And what did he do? He would put the camera on the TV. There were many early videos that he did where he had tweaked the inside of the TV so that he really manipulated then Mayor John Lindsay, who he had appropriated from a press conference. So you'd have Lindsay saying, okay, you can start recording. Okay, you can start recording. And to me, those early videos were a lot like what Warhol was doing with his Marilyn silkscreen paintings. We're taking somebody from popular culture, from the media, which was all around, and then twisting it, or making, using an iconic image. So what I'm going to show you as Nam June's, one of his very early tapes, it's called Beatles Electronique. And of course, those of you who are my generation remember Ed Sullivan having the Beatles on the Sunday show when your parents maybe let you look at it and maybe not. And Elvis was another thing. But so what he did was he took very familiar footage. Some of us who would go to see the films of the Beatles, Hard Day's Journey into Night. So Nam June always was a bad boy, always tweaking, pushing, questioning. So I'm going to show you this very short work called Beatles Electronique, which he did in collaboration with Judd Yalcott, who was another experimental film video maker in New York at that time. So you'll hear and see the tweaks that Paik did with found material. So my own interest in media sort of came out of course, maybe coming from a family of scientists, so of course I went into art history, but when I started at MoMA, I was in the print department, and I started the artist book collection, and if you think about the early 70s, as this video was, of course, the late 60s, it's a moment when we had Polaroid, we had artists were working with offset, with all kinds of alternative materials going very counter to what was then a very small gallery system. So works that were not very expensive. Ed Ruscha was doing books. I even bought them for $2. And of course, now they're $1,000 if you buy it, you know, on A-books or whatever. But so these were all counter materials, the video. And I'm going to show you another tape. So if you think about New York at that time, there was, of course, the Fillmore East, and you had people like Jimi Hendrix performing and Janis Joplin, and you had very early video makers like Stane Vasulka there at the Fillmore East shooting and documenting the music scene. And you had what was the Mercer Art Center on Mercer Street, an old hotel, and you had the kitchen where all the video happened. And of course, that hotel had a fire, and the kitchen then relocated to Broome Street, and of course, now it's in Chelsea. But I'm going to show you another video because I have an interest in this interdisciplinarity-ness of media. I think a lot of ideas come out of the blue. We expect things to go very logically when we look back at history, but of course, it's been very crazy. I'm going to show you one of David Bowie. In 85, I did a show called Music Video, The Industry and Its Fringes. And I went to the industry and knocked on doors and asked for the music videos. MTV was only 4 years old at that point. But thinking of early Beatles from the 60s, Beefheart, Devo, record industry is very bad about keeping its own things, so I got everything that I showed, 40 works, into the collection. So a couple of years ago, I got a call from David Bowie's right hand. They said, "Hi, I'm so-and-so." I said, "Hi, I'm Barbara, curator of the show. You found me from 85. And they said, "Did you ever get the music video that you requested?" Because they found my letter, original letter. I said, "Yes," and we actually reprised that show. And I'll give you all the press material. And I thought, I'm not going to let her get off the phone. I said, "You know, we really respect Mr. Bowie. If he wanted to give all his music videos archival copies, we would accept them." And that's what they did. So to acknowledge that gift, when I did my Looking at Music first show, I wanted Bowie to come in and be a VJ. He was too busy. So I had Thurston Moore do that. But I'm going to show you the first music video that he did, and you'll see there, maybe you could see the same spirit as in the Pake, and maybe a few little similarities.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom.
If you think about that moment, this is around, 72, 73. So this is Bowie working out his image. And he, if you do a little digging, it's easy to find out. He was actually studying in art school in London doing graphic art, and then with a group of friends created an art center, the Beckenham Art Center, and there he studied mime. So it's very much part of a practice that was in interdisciplinariness, and then, of course, he worked on that image of himself and perfected it. So if you think about image, of course, Marilyn Monroe had an image, so did Elvis. And if you think about artists working with that, taking a step back, of course, Cindy Sherman is 6 years later. But and of course, at that point, computers were room-sized. Artists never had access to computers at that point, unless you were given an opportunity to go into Bell Labs with experiments in art and technology. Parallel thing was in Munich with Siemens, something parallel in Amsterdam with Philips. But so here I am back at MoMA. So I joke that some of us forget that Soho wasn't just all boutiques. It was, when I started out, and of course the Twin Towers are there, it was really grungy. Now we've got a lot of good lofts. And of course, at this moment, you had incredible artists like Smithson doing his spiral jetty, going out. The white box of the museum was considered not acceptable anymore. Then you had Mud Club, a lot of music and a lot of interventions happening in this music scene. And this has been of great interest to me, these kind of areas of collaboration. And it means that I've, in my practice, I've just saved every shred of paper an artist has given me. So if you wanted to come to MoMA, it's in the library now, it's all archived. You could do research on a lot of these media pioneers. Also unknown to a lot of people like yourselves, some of you art historians, you do know, but you can go in and look at artist files and actually see the flyers, the ephemera from the screenings, the events. Sometimes there are letters. So you can make connections and where ideas were cross-filtering, because like those of you who are in school today, you know that you are talking with colleagues and something does give you an inspiration. So I'll just go quickly through this. This was the show I did about a year and a half ago, Looking at Music, the first part. So this was Nam June's collaboration of a doctored up TV set with Otto Pina, who was doing his smoke drawings at that time. Cage, of course, was very much opaque new Cage. So I put this little cluster together to make connections of who knew whom and kind of who was in the circle and talking. So certainly Yoko Ono knew Paik quite well. They met in Tokyo in the early 60s when Paik went there to make a synthesizer. They met in the aisles of something called Sogetsu. It was a hall for experimental music, and Yoko and Paik actually met in the aisle at an intermission. So this was a film that we have in the collection of Yoko, and it's, of course, John Lennon looking with adoring eyes at Yoko. It was early in their relationship. I think he always looked with adoring eyes. So this is a piece of film that got slowed down. So very beautiful portrait. I had up a Terrell interested. And, of course, I had a Bruce Nauman, his lip sync. And I was very interested in the connection between him and Steve Reich. So you heard the Paik, Beatles Electronique, the repetition, and of course Nauman with this early video, some of you have seen it, where he's repeating over and over what he's just heard in the headphones, him saying lip, lip, sync, lip, sync, and he's trying to repeat the what has just been in the delay. So for 1 hour, he repeats this for the length of the then videotape. So I had Steve's piece called Come Out, which was appropriated sound. Steve was asked to make a piece on behalf of a young black kid who was picked up and accused of a violent crime, and the kid is saying over and over in Steve's appropriated sound that he edited, come out, that he had actually been wounded and he was trying to make the blood come out to show that he wasn't the perpetrator. I was interested in the connection, which you can read. I talked with Joan Jonas a lot about Jack Smith, but Joan, as a media artist, as an artist who was doing performance before there was a name for it, you would call your performance an event, not a performance. Joan was developing her character, Organic Honey, and she had gone to see Jack Smith's Midnight Events. Those of you who have been to a Bob Wilson or know long, 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 long-length theater pieces, Richard Foreman, but Jack Smith would do these events in his loft. Jack, of course, was a visual artist, a filmmaker. You would go to his loft at midnight, and he'd pass around a joint. You would wait and wait and wait. Maybe he put on a garment that he picked up out of a rag heap, and then you slowly realized the performance had started. But for Joan, when she went to Jack's, her first event in his place, she realized what she had been embracing, which was minimalism, didn't fit her. And that's when she started to sort of change her practice. So in that exhibition looking at music, I was looking at cross influences of music on visual arts. And that was maybe a stretch. But I put in this Jack Smith head right next to Joan's Organic Honey, the video. This has I'll tell you a little anecdote on this. So I did the backstory on how this got into MoMA in 1959. It was done in 58. Turns out Steichen was very responsive. He was our photo curator, was very responsive to young artists. And he actually acquired this from Jack Smith at the time, which is fascinating. I read the letters. They're crazy. Jack was crazy. I had Lucinda Child's piece Vehicle from her part of the Nine Evenings event at the New York Armory. And, of course, it worked with Doppler sound. She's moving buckets filled with cement, getting them in phase and out of phase. I had Bob Whitman. I had this is from our music video collection. And, of course, Laurie Anderson, herself playing violin. We've done a lot over the years with Laurie, who, of course, studied violin when she was in high school, but she then did art history and studio art at Columbia. And this self-playing violin is now in our collection and is in the gallery. So that's an example of Otto Pina's smoke drawing. He's the one who put the puppet pearls on Paik's TV. It was a collaboration. So I think I'm just going to go through. I'm going to leave time for a wonderful video. So when I think of my interest in music video, I did this show a couple of years ago called Automatic Update, all with work from our collection. So when you think of technology, and some of you who are making it, when I teach, I say to my students, you're the curator of your life, and you better take care of your work, because nobody else is. And you better be organized about it, have your titles, have your dates, have your screenings, have that all in a file, and update even the file. And I know it's hard, but software keeps changing. So I did a show which kind of was addressing how work is, software is constantly updated. And it's not just because the industry is mean to us who are practitioners. It's because they are making it better, but we have to keep up. So one work that was on the wall, we acquired this a couple of years ago, Rafael Lozano Hammer. Maybe some of you have seen other work. He took little teeny-weeny LCD screens. There are maybe, I forget if there are 21 of them. And there's a computer terminal. You can just barely see it on the right. You could come up and write a question. And each little screen shows 33 questions per minute. They come cycling through. And he chose that speed because that's just at the level of legibility, or your brain can capture it. So, and of course, when we acquired this, we got a manual this fat of how to operate, how to upgrade, and the software is all, off the shelf, common. It's not anything specially written. But it still is going to take a lot of doing to keep this running. I'm very lucky, I think, to work at MoMA. We have a media conservator, somebody who was hired 2 years ago who is dedicated to the upgrading of these works. And we now have probably 1,000 single-channel videos and I would say at least, I don't know, a couple hundred installation pieces. And this is a work of Jennifer and Kevin McCoy we acquired, and it's a table with like a Lazy Susan. It's called Our Second Date. And they were studying film history, film theory in Paris with Raymond Bellour and a couple of others. And on their second date, they went to see Godard's Weekend. And so this is their memory of the film and their date. So you have, of course, the action from the film, which is this couple trying to leave Paris for their fling. And there's a horrible traffic jam, and they never get out. So on the Lazy Susan, in the middle of this table, are all the little toy parts playing the characters. They're just inert, but the characters. So around the Lazy Susan are like five little lights and about five little cameras. So there's under the table a computer, and it's kind of doing an edit, live edit of Weekend. So when we acquired it, I had our sculpture conservator talk with them so that the little parts, which are from architectural models, were made with the best possible materials so that it would not fade within 2 months. It would maybe fade in 5 years. But, you know, so, and then with them, it has to be, are we going to leave it like a Bruce Conner, which is saggy, baggy material? If you go and look at a Bruce Conner assemblage, you know, it gets saggy baggy, and you're not going to replace the wet webbing and the netting that hold a weighted thing. With them, do we ultimately replace the faded trees, which come from architectural models? Or, you know, so I think with them, we might upgrade. Koi Archangel, artist who some of you know well, has been doing all kinds of things with obsolete technology. So I thought for MoMA, the appropriate piece would be abstraction. So it's called Two Projectors, One Upside Down. And he uses one VCR player. You can see, And it's just, there's no image, nothing playing. So the projectors are tweaked just to have, one of them has the pink color, one of them has the blue. So with him, we had to be careful in figuring out what exactly the hue is, because I'm not going to be around, he's not going to be around. So how do we get our projectors 20 years from now to look like that? So that's what I worry about, but a lot of you don't worry about. So I think I'll move on. We have this wonderful little Paul Pfeiffer. It was in the show on a flat panel. Some of you, I'm sure, have seen it, John 3:16, which I didn't realize was a slogan that was picked up and people would actually wear it at basketball games maybe 15 years ago, that signs would be held up. But, you know, it's the biblical passage. So I think with this, Paul was thinking about, these are like thousands of images appropriated from basketball games. It's just the basketball, always the same size, but different hands. So it's a lot about sports. And when maybe one comes from a family without means, you dream of course, being rich, maybe. Or you dream of being like a god. And how do you do that? By playing basketball really well and getting on a team. So, you know, it's like, so who are we? What's identity? What's life? What's culture? What's the reality of our everyday? And it's, so this little flat screen is kind of at the height of a very tall basketball player. And it's on a pole out from the wall. And you just see the basketball. So this also was an automatic update. So, and then the last piece in the show was by the artist Xu Bing, X-U-B-I-N-G, who is really interesting artist who, under the time of Mao, was really squashed. He was a quite good draftsman, was sent down, did a lot of very simple prints at that point. He worked with the farming community and did the newspapers and all kinds of things. When he came back to Beijing when it was possible, he went to art school and became a very, very, even more versatile printmaker. But he has been doing media in the last couple of years. So this is Book from the Ground, where he was interested in the icons that we all live with in the world. This is a software that he made taking those icons so the viewer could come into MoMA, into the gallery, sit down at a terminal, and maybe there's a pretty woman or a handsome guy sitting on the other side, and you could say, I love you, just, and then it would come up in the characters. So he's got it in, I think, in Chinese, French. He's done many languages the same way that Raphael Lozano-Hammer has done his 33 questions using lots and lots of different languages. So I think I'll just cut the PowerPoint there. I could go on and on, but I'm going to go back to playing a couple of videos. So I thought it would be fun to bring you up to date, maybe with two works that I've seen recently. One is by the artist Candice Brights. This was at the gallery Yvonne Lambert, and it was just up in Toronto, if you're up there, at the power plant. And so for some of you who are in cinema studies, I thought this would be good for you guys. So imagine you're walking into an installation, and the first thing you see, there are in total 16 flat panels. Two are right at the entrance, and him, it's 23 films that Jack Nicholson is in, and you get the title credits. Her, it's Meryl Streep, and 28 films that she's in, and you have that rolling. When you walk into the Jack side, it's a him and a her, so you've got 7 flat panels, 2, 3, 2. So it's the characters of Jack from 23 films. From when he's really a young puppy to being the older guy he is now. And what Candice did was she spent a year really, really looking at the language and the images of these films. So she appropriated in a different way from Paik. She created a script. So, and it's almost like, I know like Julia Kristeva and many people have written about cinema and Freud and psychoanalysis, but so what she did was she created a kind of, it's not a portrait of them, it's them in Hollywood cinema, them having a kind of soliloquy, each one. So I thought I'll just play a couple of minutes of him and a couple of minutes of her.
I have your first name, mister.
Who are you?
I don't know.
Who are you, Neil?
I don't know. Let's introduce Dave to some of the rest of us. Why don't you tell Dave what brought you here?
Yeah, thank you.
I'm sure he'd love to listen to what you guys have to say. We always do.
I'd love to join the group.
Hi, I'd love to join the group.
Know how hard it was for me to come here.
I don't know.
Tell us about yourself.
I used to be somebody else, but I traded him in.
Stop this cheap bullshit!
Is there supposed to be any way to stop this metamorphosis?
Stop this cheap bullshit!
Most people go back to being themselves, right?
I used to be somebody else, but...
Tell me, what it is that you're trying to say.
I failed to marry. You know the punishment for that.
I don't want to know.
I failed to marry.
I'm sorry.
Marry.
I shall never have children, a husband.
I'm sad that I won't be able to plan your wedding.
He never wrote to me. He never called me.
I saw that I had been an amusement for him.
I'm nothing since.
Nothing wrong.
As though nothing happened?
Nothing since then.
He never wrote to me. He never called me.
Oh. Okay, yeah. I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
You should be smart enough to know not to start something where nothing can come of it. You're only going to make a mess.
I should have slept with him. Maybe that would have made it easier.
He told me I was beautiful.
I'll tell you what it indicates to me.
But please.
Trick is to have you always want more, right? So... they're soliloquies. They're also, of course, like little cutout dolls because they're removed from the situation and the other people. You might hear a little bit of words from a couple of the people they're playing with, but it's pretty much Meryl and Jack. But they're in these roles, so it's funny. The first time I saw it, I thought, Jack is always Jack, no matter who he's playing. And Meryl, the character actor, is really taking on and really inhabiting these roles, but they're both there on screen in these, you know, major films. They're known to all of us. We've seen at least one film of each, most of us, maybe multiples. So it's interesting the way then an artist like Candace has worked with cinema and devised this structure to make a work that says something about our cultural world. So I'll do one more video, and I'm going to run the whole thing. I always feel I'm very lucky because I get to see a lot of new work always. And I had shown the work of a very small group in Paris a couple of years ago and kind of knocked on their door to see what they were up to. And they just spent 3 years making this short piece, which I've submitted to our new directors series, and I hope it will get in. I think it will. So it's 15 minutes. It'll be part of the shorts that play in February. So you're going to see this. It's going to have, because it was made as a preview copy for MoMA, unfortunately you're going to see a faded MoMA preview running through it. But so it's called Logorama, and in kind of parallel maybe to what Shubing was doing with the icons that are so familiar to us, these guys took the logos that are so familiar, and it's just extraordinary. So it took them 3 years, and we'll run it.
Good morning, life.
Good morning, sun. How are you, skies above? Gee, it's great to be alive and in love. Good morning, life. Good morning, bird. Sing out your happy tune. Feel so good, 'cause I'll be seeing her soon. Last night, she said she loved me. What a pity to part. I slept with both eyes open, waiting for today to start. Good morning, life.
It was, you know what? You should come with us next
time.
No,
man, I don't like zoos.
Oh, man, but the kids go apeshit for it.
Yeah, well, I don't see my kids that much. Besides, it's depressing.
So it's by a group in Paris called H5. So they do, obviously, some commercial work, but they do come out of art school, and so that's that. So that's what I have to show. Yeah, if we want to do a little bit of conversation.
Chris and I are just going to ask a couple of questions, and then we'll just open it up.
Well, I guess I'm particularly interested in how you framed your own trajectory, which seems to run really beautifully parallel to the emergence of these media in a lot of ways, that you were sort of there on the ground and picking up on it and seeing how things were developing, meeting the artists. I guess I wonder if you could say anything more about MoMA. It seems incredibly prescient that MoMA was able to develop a media department so early. I know at the Philadelphia Museum of Art we're still talking about, I mean, we have been collecting video, but that's still something that needs to really take off, and you have over 1,000 videos. So I don't know, I wonder if you could just maybe say a few words about the position of the media department at MoMA and how it relates to some of the other departments, painting and sculpture, more traditional departments.
Well, maybe we'll go to echo it. So video didn't start out, I mean, video started out in a very small way. So some of you, Judith, sitting here in the front row, knows that I was in the print department at the beginning, and it was part of Projects. And Projects was a series started in 71 for MoMA to be responsive to installation art. And Projects got a little bit of money from the NEA and a little bit here and there, and it was very contemporary. So in 74, I had worked on a show that went to Australia. It had video in it. So that was actually the first of the, in quote, shows that I did. NEA gave money for equipment, and it was small. It was a very beginning. We shared a gallery, a joke, with Thomas Wilfred's Lumia Suite. So some of you who study kinetic art might remember or know of that name. And it was like looking at a screen and a light show. And the patterns kept changing. And I would find kids either smoking a joint down there or necking or whatever. And it was dark. But, you know, you could go and look at Thomas Wilfred half of the day, or you could then look at the video that we did on these two monitors. So the first videos were acquired, say, a year later. So MoMA was, you could say, yes on the ball. Ronchette Rockefeller, I did know her. She was a wonderful trustee who supported new things. So Ronchette Rockefeller was on the video advisory committee. And it was she who then introduced us to Mr. Morita of Sony. And I did a presentation to him, and we got more equipment. So it sort of grew slowly. And of course, in the very beginning, videotapes were not editioned. They were $250 and for an archival, unlimited edition copy. Because we have... So video was part of Projects, the film department. I was talking with Larry Kardish, a colleague in our film department. People in the film department didn't want it. So video stayed kind of under Projects for a while, and then ultimately it went into film. Ultimately, film was renamed Film and Video, then it was renamed Film and Media, and then only 2-3 years ago was it made its own department. So But at least we used to say that you created a mass. You know, we had all of these titles. We were showing work. I got a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation, which allowed me to start Video Viewpoints. So many of the artists here have spoken in that. I knew that at the beginning, everything was very experimental. People didn't want to be in an institution. Gradually, things kind of solidified, and artists did want to be shown in museums. So Video Viewpoints was a way to track the history. So I did very early on record all of those. Many of them have been transcribed, and so it's, again, primary reference material. So to have many of the artists in this room speaking, it means catching them at a point in their career when maybe it's all new or you've evolved, but to get the people, the practitioners, the artists talking about the work, to me was very, very important, and was like this a unique opportunity for an audience to come and hear someone and see the work and be able to ask questions.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask a question about artist spaces. One of the things that I think is really distinctive and wonderful about Looking at Music Part 2 is the way that it gives you a sense of place, and the wall labels and things tell you about that place, and that it comes out of a kind of moment of economic crisis, and that there are garages and holes in the wall and punk clubs, and it's very distinctive, even if some of that work now is courtesy of Warner Brothers. So you see a kind of movement into industrial commercial spaces from those distinct spaces. But I'm wondering if we look at this work, for example, now, or the contemporary moment, whether you think there is such a sense of place marking the work, as Syracuse marked the work of a group of people, or New York, and whether you think it will be possible, 30 years from now, to do that kind of show with the kind of new media that we have and the way that artists are working.
It's a very good question. Indeed, the show that's up now very much looks at the trajectory from 71 to early 80s, looking at music side two, and it starts with Patti Smith and it ends with Basquiat, and it does have a lot of ephemera. So I did speak with over 40 people about the moment, got all kinds of leads to then, ferret out other material. Photographers who did more documentary photography, I got them to give the photographs, so now they're in the library for future people to do research as well. But indeed, the present moment, and that's why when I teach, I tell students, you've got to save things, you've got to print it out. I still think where we all come from and place plays a role, that we are all online, we're traveling, or we're doing virtual things, whether getting the information, but still there are conversations that happen, and there are very distinct situations. So maybe we don't have as many or need alternative, in quote, spaces. Maybe it's happening then, like this organization here does a show in different venues. But still, the archiving, and I think what Slout has done with the DVDs, or that's a form of information or a form of being able to do research.
If I could maybe follow up on that and just ask, there was a lot of documentary material, which was fascinating to see, and it was sometimes on the wall or it was laid out in cases. And so it did present the work. This is we're talking about the show at MoMA recently on
Looking at Music, Side 2. And it's up through November, so you have a chance.
It's a great show. Showing interconnections between artists and punk music and so forth. And so, but it was very historicized. Through the use of all this material, which helped you to understand where this music was being made, artists designing record covers. There were lots of videos or MP3 players and so on that you could hear the music, drawings that related. But I wonder, is there a tension, or were you at all attempting to recreate? I mean, it would be very difficult to do, but what it would be like to hear, Patti Smith in concert, or to hear some of the music within those spaces that were at that time marginal. There's a tension between putting it historically and seeing all this documentation, MoMA as an exhibition space, what's possible.
Well, I had the the one gallery, and in talking with people, I knew I would do a film program in the theater as well, and I joke that to do a film program is really labor-intensive. You have to get all the rights, you've got to ship it in. So I decided early on I would do a very, very, very small film program in the theater, but it did run. I started out with Taxi Driver. We have it in the, we own it. I decided to start with that one because it wasn't that the music was important, it was because it was showing a picture, a view of New York at that moment. I knew I couldn't, you know, recreate the feeling of a club, but Bob Gruen was generous in giving photographs and then let us show his edited video of Patti Smith at CBGB's, and he's got in there, I think, the Dolls and a couple of other groups that were very much of the time. So the very first projection that you saw when you walked in was a very performative work that James Nares did. James Nares is still a painter and picked up the guitar, was in one of the punk bands. I interviewed him. He talked with, I just blanked on her name, from Colleen Fitzgibbon. I had them do a conversation, which you can listen to online or in the acoustic guide, about that moment and what it was like living on the Lower East Side, where everybody did collaborate. You maybe shared video equipment or a Super 8 camera. You would act in one person's and you would be the sound person on another. So I showed some of those films. Like, I had John Lurie's Men in Orbit. And so I had various films like that on view in the theater, but you had to be attentive and see the program listed. So I could bring it in a way to life through the music, and Judith did a music video that's in the show. And so these are all early music videos, in a way, kind of pre-MTV.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if we should maybe open up the conversation now, just so that we have plenty of time for that. If there are people in the audience who have questions you'd like to ask.
I mentioned the artist files, yeah. Well, as of a number of months ago, our librarians were saying they weren't going to print out the web e-flux or the, you know, announcements, but I realize it's really important that we do it because it's, like you say, there's no other, you know, record, and, you know, and you're always needing to cross-check when you're doing a catalog raisonné or doing your research. You need to have it, you know, factually. Your editor is going to say, where is that date in print, you know? So yeah, it's a very good question. So up until a number of months ago, we weren't printing them out, but
it's going to be a gap.
Yeah, and it's going to be a very long gap. You know,
Will?
I have a question about how the different departments at MoMA work with artists.
A conversation now, this is something more in the last, say, 5-6 years. MoMA notoriously is still very bureaucratic, and all of these departments were little fiefdoms, but it's much less. There's a lot more conversation that goes on. I used to drive me crazy that Richard Serra, he did video and film for a while, and he, of course, did drawings, and, of course, he does his enormous sculptures. So to see those only in each of the departments, not the mega ton of Richard, but, no, you need to see across. So that is happening, and it is happening that... I also used to joke that painting and sculpture has the most real estate, and it still does, but... They're putting more other mediums in. So you had another question? Or
what's allowing that conversation to start develop within the different departments?
I think it's generational. And I think people my generation and younger don't see the need. We still do not have a, in quote, contemporary department. We've got everybody curatorially identified by a medium, but there is a lot more cross work. So you might see exhibitions, like even mine had, you know, I borrowed drawings, I borrowed photographs, I borrowed from other departments.
Is that happening with your personal relationships with the curators, or are there like little groups that are created where people are together?
It's a good question. We do meet. So like I was saying, I'm part of what's called a contemporary working group. So it means I'm the contemporary curatorial from every department is present. Another project that we had over the last 5 years, which has been very, very exciting, was it's the woman's, I forget what we call it, or it's like a project that was initiated by a donor, a woman who wanted to give a grant, and it could be used in any way. It could be used for babysitting, it could be used, but of course what we did was we did a symposium a year and a half ago called Feminist Futures, and it was a one-day Saturday event. MoMA was unprepared. We sold out within like a half hour. Right. And we then we opened it up so that people could see in our other theater a live, you know, feed. But so that actually has been 5 years of a group of women curators meeting every week, every other week, to discuss what work by women is in the collection. And of course, that symposium helped us kind of think through, because my wonderful colleague who's up in Boston, his now name just went out of my head, but she was saying she could imagine a gallery where, you know, you would see and make connections. So we are indeed trying to do that, and we are putting up more work by women where they belong, we're trying to acquire. And of course, Connie Butler's show, WAC, has had a big influence too. And of course, that's a show she started when she was a curator out in LA, and then it came to MoMA. So there will be a book published in May. The result of this research and initiative, so maybe I'll ask you for a good title suggestion. As of a week ago, we'd gone through like thousands of titles for the book. But anyway, so we've all written about different things. So I've written about video as it emerged and moved into media. So looked at our machine show. Lillian Schwartz was a very early kinetic artist. She was out at Bell Labs. So I touch on various people, including Joan Jonas and Valley Export. Mm-hmm. So for that research, again, it's like what I did with looking at music was, you know, going in through the archives and trying to read everything I could and talked with people, and felt very committed to making sure people didn't forget someone like Annabella Geiger in Brazil, in Rio, who, parallel to Elia Otisica and Ligia Clark, was working very much outside the box, very unusual for the time, was working very interdisciplinarily, and she did video at a time when there was martial law in Brazil, when it was illegal to have a video camera, and she did these amazing works where one is four drawings that she does. She's got Ameto or something, it means crutch. And then she draws Latin America, Lat-M. So, and the Latin America, then you think, you know, what's the relationship of Brazil to Latin America itself? Because at that point, artists were not really communicating within each country because of course, political restrictions, money, you know, and they were working locally. But Annabella was very important, so I felt very important for me to include her in this book because she is in our print department with early prints and with two very early videos. Because this history keeps getting written and rewritten with just the same old, and to me it's very important that we keep this broader view. So.
I thought that was very interesting in the music show that it seemed to me that there was a very strong current of very interesting work about that engaged, for example, S&M sexuality, or the question of race in pieces like Adrian Piper's Funk License, or even the Blondie Rapture video, I thought was very interesting. With this is a, for those of you who haven't seen the show, the as Blondie is walking around singing Rapture, there are images of well, there's a an African American performer dressed all in white with a top hat. There's an Uncle Sam. There's a graffiti artist. There's
but
a Native
Basquiat.
American chief, and this is all going on in the background. But it isn't. I thought it was interesting that that isn't addressed really explicitly in the show, that it's part of the scene. And I wondered if you could maybe talk explicitly about some of those pieces that engage those questions and how you see it work, how you see them working with some of the other works that seem to be addressing much more of a white audience, you know, in contrast to Piper's piece, which is teaching white audiences how to engage black music.
I very, very consciously, purposefully, you know, of course, did research and thinking, and some, there are always wonderful surprises. So as I was going through the artist files, I went through Adrian's, and there we had the poster for her funk lessons. I emailed everybody in the show to let them know they were included. So I let Adrian know, and she's living in Berlin, and she wrote back. She was very pleased to be included. Of course, because I included Patti Smith, I thought I've got to have, you know, Mapplethorpe, because they were very close. They really were emerging together, figuring out what they were, who they were, what their identity and what their practice was. So when I went through our database, because as a curator I can go through and see what we have in the collection, the only pieces of Mapplethorpe we had were of Two Flowers. And I thought, well, that's not going to do. So I borrowed a record from someone. So I was able to have actually Mapplethorpe in a couple of ways. I have Patti's self-portrait, which is a drawing, which is a brilliant drawing from 71. I've got her portrait of Robert, which is a beautiful little pencil sketch. And then I've got, through a record cover, his portrait of her looking very tough. I thought of Jimmy DeSanta because I knew of Jimmy, and I knew him. And he was a photographer very much on the New York scene, also documenting. His photos were in the Soho Weekly News. They were, you know, shown. And he did very explicit bondage kinds of works. So when I looked at what we had of Jimmy, there was only one, and it was in a portfolio called End of a Decade, 1980. And there were 30 works. So I went through each work in the portfolio, of course, put in Jimmy DeSanta's, put in Barrett Boyle. Nobody, only one other person I've talked with remembered Barrett Boyle, who died, but that was a Xerox and was very tough and punky, and I put it in because I thought, and it's framed, and I thought it's someone who was of that moment and trying to bring him back. I also talked with Laurie Simmons, who's the executor of the Jimmy DeSanta estate, and she graciously, on behalf of the estate, gave a portfolio of Jimmy's to the museum as part of my research. So, and that has gone into the photography department. So I was trying indeed to bring some of that up. My colleague, who's the librarian, the head librarian, is an amazing individual, Mylon Houston. So I would say to Mylon, oh, I really, really want this David Warnerovich album. It was available for $100. He bought it. And then I wanted something else, and he just bought it. You know, so he really understood and understands and is a wonderful, wonderful colleague. So I always think back to a statement that Alfred Barr made that's brought up many times. Alfred Barr would say, it doesn't matter what department something goes in as long as it gets into the museum. It can be changed later. So if something even comes into the library in 20 years, it could be moved. You know, so I don't care. I care that it comes in, that it gets cataloged, and then is recorded.
Using
Yeah, well, I think it does in work. And, of course, Automatic Update had only 5 or 6 pieces. So, of course, the work of the McCoys has a nostalgia for that moment in their lives. But certainly we acquired a work of Rodney Graham where it's called Rheinmetall Victoria 8. So he took a beautiful typewriter, the Rheinmetall, a German typewriter. And who's seen Rheinmetall Victoria 8? A number of you. It does have a sense of nostalgia looking back, but there's this real elegance and cleanness, and the typewriter is there in the projection. The projector is a really beautiful 1950s projector. It's in the room. So the same way Tacito will put her projector plainly visible, that it's a 16-millimeter projector, which is definitely obsolete. They're hardly made anymore. They're hard to maintain, and MoMA doesn't distribute its films anymore in 16, I don't even think. We have hardly any orders. But so, yes, so he did play with the nostalgia and the content by having the typewriter have it looks like snow coming down on it, and it makes you feel that it's like a snowy night in Berlin in 1930, which then makes you think politically about the rise of Nazism and things. So indeed, it does happen. But the nostalgia in itself, you need more than just the nostalgia, of course.
Do you have a question? Maybe we should make this the last question and then have some informal conversation afterwards.
I was just wondering what you showed the work of Ray Archangel, who does have some work that's based on the premise of being shared through the internet or changing software code, that I guess MoMA's role when it takes over ownership of that type of work that's based upon like being viral and free and kind of their awareness to their own role as an institution and taking on that work and what that means to own a piece of work that's based on the premise of being shared or being accessible to a general public.
It's funny. In our next acquisition...
Could you repeat that question or summarize it just so people over here... I think you probably didn't hear it.
So, like, the question of then work that is viral, that is meant to be shared, you know, how do we address that as an institution that's collecting as well as exhibiting? So artists who are interesting are called... what are the ones in Amsterdam... A couple. They work. You would go to their site, and all of a sudden, it looked like a virus had taken over your computer. So I wanted to show that, and I wanted to actually get it into the museum for Automatic Update. And they're very. They didn't want to. It belongs out there. Then another case would be Marilyn Minter, who's artist who has had a career with photography and painting, and she just made a video a year or so ago, cost $40, and it's been shown at Times Square on the Spectre board, and she just wants it out. And of course Madonna did help her underwrite it because it was part of a fashion shoot, but I want it. The same way that I wanted these music videos, because it's part of a moment. So I would really like the Jody. I would like to have Jody, but you know, at the moment they still don't want to come in. But Marilyn has agreed that yes, indeed, we'll get an archival copy of that. The same way that we got archival copies of the Bowie and these other works that were. The music videos that we've gotten in, I have been very clear about what ones. It's not just any old one. I was very interested in works that were hybrids or were a collaboration between a visual artist and a musician, that the visual artist had equal, you know, say in the creation. So, like Judith and the piece that she made. I'm really interested in the collaborations that push boundaries and definitions, and the good question that you raised about the viral. What do you do? And
Well, let me thank you all for coming, and I'd like to thank Barbara London for joining us, and also thank you to Slot for hosting us. I should have said that at the beginning.